Hello friends, I'm Matt Baume. The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Huge thanks to everyone who keeps the show going. If you're enjoying it, please head over to patreon.com and search for Sewers of Paris to pledge your support. And now, we're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest, comedian David Morgan, says...
There was a letter to my parents on the front doorstep when we got back off holiday, and it said, Dear Mr. and Mrs. Morgan, you may or may not be aware that your son is a homosexual.
The topic is Dawson's Creek, rent, and British game shows. Has anyone ever surprised you with the lengths they were willing to go on your behalf? Once, when I was in high school, a bunch of drama club nerds were going to Denny's, and I was supposed to join them, but my friend who had a car never showed up. So I walked an hour across town to get there, feeling particularly unloved. When I arrived, one of the most popular kids in the group, a guy so awesome I'd barely ever mustered up the courage to talk to him, was missing. Apparently, when he found out that my ride had bailed and I was walking, he left to go drive around town looking for me. For months, I'd been wishing that someday we could be friends, and that night I found out that as far as he was concerned, we already were. My guest this week is David Morgan, comedian and co-host of the British panel show Safe Word. As a shy, young homosexual, he wasn't sure of the best way to come out to his parents, his father a cop, his mother a teacher, and devoted churchgoer. Fortunately, his school decided to do him the favor of informing his parents for him. It wasn't until years later that he found out what his mother had to say to the headmaster in the confrontation that ensued. Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. I'm joined today by comedian David Morgan. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hello. Oh, no. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited.
Wonderful. So what's the entertainment that changed your life?
In terms of coming out, probably Jack in Dawson's Creek, sadly enough.
Do you know the anguish I went through over a kiss? One stupid little kiss. Most people don't have to do that.
You're right. They don't.
Then why me? I don't want to be different. I didn't ask to be gay.
No more than I asked for a gay son. But boy, am I glad I got one.
You don't mean that?
Yeah, I do.
You know, strangely, Jack comes up very seldom on the show. Tell me a little bit more about, like, were you watching the show for a long time before he came out? Or, like, did you discover when that coming out episode happened?
So, it kind of happened in the UK. It was 1999 when all this happened. I was 15 and at school. And around that time in the UK, there was just a lot of gayness. Like, that was the go-to shocking storyline for anyone to do. So... as well as Jack coming out, we had Queer as Folk. A few years earlier, there'd been the Brookside lesbian kiss.
I fancy you in the same way I fancied Peter Harrison. I want to kiss you the way I kissed him. Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. It's okay. No, it's not. I've said too much and I've spoiled everything. How could you possibly stay friends with her now? Because I want to.
Like, there'd been loads of sort of gay stuff happening. And then even in a child's soap opera called Biker Grove, we had a gay kiss in that, which was amazing. And so it kind of all kind of came to a head. And then I had been watching Dawson's Creek because it was on a Sunday morning. And so I used to watch it because, you know, it was... fun and interesting and a bit sexy, and Jack Kerr Smith was super hot, like ludicrously everything I Google now hot, and so I think I just was drawn to that kind of idea. And I knew I was gay, and I knew I should probably come out because all the kids at school knew anyway, and I think it sort of pushed me to do it because I knew that my world wouldn't break as much as his. Like, it was a lot easier. My parents were fine.
So describe the circumstances for folks who haven't seen the show or don't know the characters. Yeah. Who was Jack and how did he come out?
So Jack and Andy were kind of late comers to the show, and then they came out and their mum was very ill and they looked after her, and they were twins. And Jack was sort of how we'd say here, a lad. I don't know what the term is in the US now, thinking about it.
A bro,
yeah. Although he was a bit nicer than a bro, but yeah, he was a lad from over here, and so not your stereotypical gay. Like, I mean, if you were reading the show, Pacey's definitely the one you pick out first. So he was kind of struggling with it, and her, and just the only bit of the scene I can properly remember is Jack kind of crying helplessly on the stairs, just like tears everywhere. And I like a vulnerable man, so that was excellent. And then Andy kind of just smiling at him, and I remember it being heartbreaking, but also so powerful, because I don't think saying it out loud for the first time is really interesting thing. I don't know if it is anymore, but it was for me, definitely kind of talking to myself about being gay, which sounds weird, really makes it real. And it's almost like you can feel it lifting, like you can say, oh, I've admitted it now, I'm done. Like, it's really good. And so that kind of helped me with that whole situation, I think.
Were you having a conversation with yourself over a period of time to come to terms with what you were?
Yeah, properly. I mean, everyone gets asked the, so when did you know question. It's like, well, around the time I started realizing that boys were hot. Like, it's just, I'd known for ages and ages and ages, didn't really have a word for it. I went to a Catholic school when I was at primary school, so we definitely didn't have a word for it. And I realised that I had to stop hiding it, I think, in my second to last year at secondary school, just because I was bored of telling people I wasn't when I knew that I was. Because I got called it all the time. Like, I was not a Jack gay. Like, I was a Jack from Will and Grace gay. Like, it was what everyone was aware. Like, I mean, I say in my set even, I didn't come out, I just confirmed rumours. Like, it's not the same.
So how old were you when the Dawson's Creek coming out happened?
I was 15. Okay. It was March 1999.
So you were not the most masculine-presenting child?
Oh, God, no. Like, they tried. They tried everything. I was a very, very quiet child as a young kid. Like, I wouldn't say anything to anyone. Like, I was pretty much mute. And my mum's a teacher, and she realised that would hold me back in life. So I got sent to every class that ever existed ever. So I did football, cricket, swimming, but then also drama, dance, singing. And I took to half of those a lot easier than the other half, and I was never into football. I wasn't into wrestling and stuff. Like, I didn't like what boys liked. I liked singing and Disney and cartoons and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Lots of cartoons. Yeah.
Was it initially hard when you started going to more performance stuff for a shy child? Did you struggle to come out of your shell, or were you like, oh, now that I'm on a stage, this is easy?
Weirdly, when there is the artifice of theatre around a thing, I came out of my shell. Like, I'm very rule oriented. Like, as I said, my mum was a teacher, my dad was a policeman, so I didn't have fun for my entire childhood. Like, it was very rule based. I'm very, very good at sticking to rules. And so when the rules are, this is a place and time where you're allowed to be an extrovert, this is a place and time where you can be centre of attention, I allowed myself to do that in a way that I didn't anywhere else.
So what kind of shows were you in where you discovered that, oh, okay, it's okay for me to have that voice?
So I did amateur dramatics a lot. So my first ever stage performance was in Oliver, which I think is a legal requirement. I was a workhouse boy and one of Fagin's kids. And more importantly, I was understudy Dodger. Thank you, guys. He never got ill, despite me trying to kill him. But so I did that. And then I did, like, Barnum. I was in kind of the background of all the scenes. Like, and I joined a youth theatre group where we did loads of shows.
I'd never really thought about it, but Oliver must be so much better with children who have actual British accents.
Yes, yeah. Although I'm from a place called Solihull, which is in the Midlands, so we're not Cockneys, and so our Cockney accents were still dog shit. Like, they were still terrible. What, governor? Like, it's just no, it's not okay.
So it doesn't matter who's performing the show. There's always going to be bad accents, child accents.
Definitely. No real Cockney has ever been in Oliver.
So, like, then you said once you got into your later school, you'd left it at the door. You left the shyness at the door.
Yeah, a little
bit
more.
What changed?
I found my tribe. Like, so when I was at primary school, it was a Catholic primary school, so it was teeny tiny. There were 22 people in my year at school, so, like, that's no people. And I didn't fit in with any of the other kids. I didn't like what they liked, really, apart from when there was one boy called Liam who liked New Kids on the Block, and I obviously liked New Kids on the Block, so we bonded over that. But then he also liked football, so, you know, we fell out. And then when I moved to secondary school, because the school kind of quadrupled in size, there were 1,200 people in my year. I could be a little bit more outspoken because I was under less scrutiny. And also I could find my tribe. There were other kids a bit like me.
So what was your tribe like?
I still secluded myself from people. I didn't have like a massive group of friends, but I did that on the weekends. Like my friends were my Saturday afternoon drama friends. Like that was my tribe, the kids that would sing Les Mis and Angela Webber at each other and talk about this amazing new thing they'd found. Like when I discovered Rent, it was the best thing in the world. Like that was, because that was again over my kind of coming out period, I discovered Rent thanks to an older gay man, which was always good. I say older gay man, like he was 10 years younger than I am now. Like that's horrible, but in my head he's still like, you know, oh my god, he's like a grown up. Yeah.
Rent has that effect. I remember it like I was in high school when it was just hitting, and it really makes you feel like you're part of a dangerous adult world.
Oh my god, yeah. It's so and also tender, because quite a lot of gay storylines you get heartbreak and brokenness and just drama everywhere, whereas in Rent, yes, there is high drama and it is about people living with AIDS and stuff, but there's some beautiful tender moments, like when they're shopping for coats and Angel just says, "Kiss me, it's beginning to snow."
I do not deserve you, Angel. Give
wait!
All you do,
what's on the floor?
Give
let's see some more
to show.
No, 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 no.
How you've touched me so.
Kiss me, it's beginning.
You're like, well, that is beautiful and tender and gorgeous, and then I'll Cover You is the sweetest love song between two gay men, and that helped a lot with how I felt about being gay and how it wasn't going to be as much for drama as perhaps everyone had told me it was going to be. So I've always said, I think when you come out to your parents, you're not going, hi mum and dad, I would like to live the rest of my life with a man who I love very much and will get married and maybe adopt some pugs. What they hear is, hey mum and dad, I want to fuck men. And it's so visceral. And doing that at 15 is like, no one wants to talk to their parents about sex ever. But despite what your parents or anyone you tell think they're going to hear, they do hear, hello, I want to have sex with men. Rather than, hello, I'm a 15-year-old boy who is experiencing feelings towards men and not women. That was terrifying to me, that mum would realize that I'd been Googling things she wouldn't want me to have Googled. Like,
sure, and especially like at that point, you probably didn't even realize yourself exactly what is gay? What does that mean for me?
Oh my god, I know entirely. And Queer as Folk helped. It was great. I used to watch it at home. I had a TV in my bedroom, and I kind of would have it on very, very quiet and have my finger hovering over the off button just in case anyone came near me, came in the room. And if they said a word I didn't understand, I'd write it in a book so that I could Google it the next day. So Rossity Davis taught me everything I needed to know. In episode one, I learned what rimming was, which was very useful. So, like, well done, you.
Yeah, so Queer as Folk and Dawson's Creek, those were modeling gay world for you.
Yeah, I mean, we had a TV program as well called Gay Time TV, which was on BBC Two late night, and it was a very well-meaning gay news program, and it was like terrible. It was hosted by a comedian called Rhona Cameron, and then one of Right Said Fred, who did I'm Too Sexy, the Richard Fairbrass used to host it. I mean, British television is magnificent.
Welcome to Gay Time TV, the first ever lesbian and gay series on the BBC.
That's right. For the next 6 weeks, we'll be here queering your pitch with a brand new magazine show about lesbian and gay life.
And they would do, it's like a magazine show, and so they'd have like news stories about stuff and obviously hard-hitting stuff about STIs, because that's all we can talk about sometimes. And so that was kind of useful as well. It was a little bit more real, and I remember one strand they had running through it. There was so my local city is Birmingham, which is right in the middle of the UK. It's a Midlands town, and it was like 20 minutes away by train, so I could escape there if I needed to run away. And their gay area is called Hurst Street, and I don't know if this is the same with you, but in like provincial British cities, there's always one gay bar which burns down a lot and then gets rebuilt with the money. You know, because it's an insurance job. And there was one in Birmingham called Angels, and it used to burn down every year at around about October so it could reopen for Pride. Like, that was what it always used to do. And so they did a documentary about them rebuilding Angels. And so that was brilliant for me because it was like a sneaky look at my gay scene before I could go there, because before I was old enough to go. And that was brilliant because, like, I didn't have the internet existed, but it wasn't as big as it is now. Like,
were you eager to go out and explore, like, even just that the gay world of Birmingham?
Oh my god, so much. Like, I'd sneak down it and walk down that street in the daytime when nothing was open, because I knew this was where the gay people lived, and it was exciting and kind of forbidden, but not forbidden, but it's just like, oh, this is where I should be, this is where I should live. And it was exciting and incredible, and I think it's like discovering the best meal you've ever had.
What did you actually explore when you were going and you could actually go into places? What did you find?
Oh god, so the first time I ever went out in Birmingham was on my 17th birthday. I snuck in because, you know, we can drink at 18 because we trust our children. Like, foolishly, we shouldn't. So I snuck in with a fake ID to a club called The Nightingale, which is amazing. And I had no idea what to do because I hadn't really gone out, because I didn't fit in at all with straight people, with the straight kids at school. So I never really did the drinking in the park, I never really did the going to the pub underage, I never went to club, I'd never been to a club before that was straight, for fear of being punched in the face. So it was kind of incredible. So I was having my first ever gay club experience, but also my first ever club experience, and so that was just unbelievable. Just people everywhere. My eyes must have been the size of a Disney princess. Like, everything was going on. It was really exciting.
I love that you compare yourself to a Disney princess, because I can just imagine you like twirling around with like like your Belle in the Bookshop.
Yes, oh, entirely, and totally too self-conscious and nervous to have done anything. I was so overwhelmed by it. Just overwhelmed by having gay friends, and there being boys kissing, and there was a drag queen, and there was music, and also the Nightingale is the greatest gay club in the world. Yeah, back then, it's got a design which is perfect. The ground floor is kind of like pop music and bars and lights going everywhere. Then they have a middle level, which is amazing, which has a restaurant on it where you can get chips at like 2 in the morning, which is, oh, sorry, fries at 2 in the morning, which is incredible, and a little kind of piano bar. And then on the top floor is your kind of one. So what you do is you pull someone on the ground floor, learn their name on the middle floor over fries, and then do sexy, dirty dancing on the top floor to figure out if you want to take them home or not. Perfect. And I remember the first time I went to another gay club, it got to about 2 in the morning. I was like, oh, I'm hungry, should we go get some chips? And the people I'm with, like, where? I was like, do all clubs not have a restaurant on the second floor? And they're like, no, that is ridiculous. So why don't all clubs just have somewhere to get dinner? Like, it's just ridiculous. So I loved the Gale. I haven't been for years. I kind of need to go back, but yeah, it was a special place to me.
Were you ready to start flirting and dancing and dating?
Oh my god, I am the worst. I still am. I am the absolute worst at pulling. Just, I've got no chat. I'm one of those people that looks at a boy and then sees the rejection instantly. Like, I just assume they're going to be like, I mean, no, what the hell are you doing over here? So I was terrible. Occasionally I'd have boys come up to me, and then I flipped to the other side because I'm so afraid of rejecting myself. I'd pretty much never reject anyone. I am the girl who can't say no. Like, it was a terrible. I did meet boys. I did do a bit of dancing, but I am still terrible at pulling. Like, oh my god, so bad.
It sounds like it's a little return of that little boy who's afraid to talk and is
oh, yeah,
too quiet.
I don't know the rules. There's no rules to flirting. Like, Grindr is so much easier. I mean, you just ask, you know, 4 questions and you're pretty much done. But back then, it's horrifying. Oh god.
When you started coming out, like, so around 15 or so, how did people react?
Everyone at school assumed I was gay anyway. And so the bullying sort of stopped. And because of Queer as Folk and Jack and everything that was happening in the UK at the time, being gay was kind of cool and exciting. Like, even Graham Norton being on television and all the cool girls at school who would never normally give me the time of day because I was a mega nerd at school, became friends with me because I was, oh my god, he's gay. I can't even hear about David's a bit gay, blah, blah, blah. And because of that, all of the bigger boys then wouldn't punch me because they wanted to have sex with the cool girls who are now my friend. So I did quite well. Like, I did quite well in that situation. And I was Nominated as head boy at my school. So, like, yeah, I did okay. I think it was kind of fine. I organized my school prom because, of course.
It's kind of funny that, like, there's the gay guy who's organizing the event for all the straight people to dance with each other.
Yes, yes, terrible.
What? So I love the term head boy. I don't think there's any equivalent in the U.S. What exactly does that mean?
I don't know. There is an equivalent. So we have like prefects who are like the school council in a weird way, and then the head boy and head girl who are like the figureheads for the school. So if the school ever does anything, me and Catherine Hurst, who was the head girl, we'd be the ones in the paper, or we'd be the ones who people would ask questions, and we'd meet parents on parents' evenings and stuff like that. Like, it was the figureheads of the school, I imagine, like the best pupils. When it turned out that I was gay, my headmaster at the time was not happy about that. So,
oh, really?
Well, there was a bit of a homophobic incident. My first show in Edinburgh, I spoke about it. It was the end story. I was also, we had like a house system, a bit like Hogwarts, and I was in bed. And there was a house music competition at the end of the year. And what was really lovely about it is it was like a sports day, but for the kids that didn't do sport. And there was a house dance bit, right? And I'm really competitive, like super competitive. And I wanted our house to win. And I couldn't get anyone to do house dance. So I did it. I just decided I'll do it on my own and I'll see if I can get some points. And I did a dance to Robbie Williams' Let Me Entertain You, because it was big at the time and it was okay. And so I did that. And as I was doing it, I'd come out. It was kind of the end of the year, so it was 5-6 months after I come out, and some of the boys just started chanting horrible things at me, you know, kind of faggot, queer, all that kind of stuff, like properly chanting. And then what was incredible though, so as it was happening, I was kind of doing my dance, and they were yelling that, but around them were all the girls who were okay with me, so they started then to cheer over the jeering. And so it became this loud, the boys got louder and the girls got louder and the boys got louder and the girls got louder. And it was just this really weird situation. I was really annoyed because I couldn't hear my music to do the dancing. And so it finished and the curtain closed, and it was just the oddest feeling. And as I left the stage, Mr. Evans, who was my PE teacher, asked if I was all right. And I didn't really know. And I was leaving school like straight away because my mum had booked a holiday, because it's slightly cheaper if you leave a day before the school holiday start. And so I was leaving straight away and I didn't know anything about it, what had gone on. And I left straight away. And on the way home, my mum got a letter. There was a letter to my parents on the front doorstep when we got back off holiday. And it said, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Morgan, you may or may not be aware that your son is a homosexual," right? Amazing. And then listed the stuff that had happened, right? And because I hadn't told my parents, like, I kept it entirely secret because I was sort of embarrassed by it and it was kind of horrible. And it's the only time when I felt, like, properly lesser than, and I really didn't like that feeling. And so it kind of, they'd had time to create a story that I'd been mean to them, and so they were just retaliating. And so my parents had to go in for a meeting with the headmaster just before we started back at school. So they went back in. And I only found this out like 5 years ago. I didn't know what happened in that meeting. All I knew is that I came back to school and it had been dealt with. But what had happened in the meeting is my headmaster had said to my mum and dad, "Oh, this has happened. And obviously, given the situation, it's probably wise if David steps down from being head boy." My mum, who is amazing, kind of went, "Mr. Chamberlain, look, if you do that, if you say that my son can't be head boy because he's gay, what I'll do tomorrow is I will phone every newspaper and television outlet that exists in the UK and get them on your front lawn because you're a homophobe." And I didn't know that, and it was incredible. So they kind of stepped back and let me do it. My mum told me this like 5 years ago. I was like, "Mum, do you not realise if you'd have let that happen, if you'd have let him kick me off and got all the papers there, like, I could have been famous in a day. Like, you'd have saved so much time." So it's kind of, it's amazing. It's amazing she did that. It was a very weird situation. It's kind of my homophobia kind of hit then.
It's so cinematic that the
oh my God,
the,
I know.
The chanting and the mysterious, like, who sent the letter?
The school, that was a headmaster.
I can't believe that.
Yeah, it's a good job I told them.
Wow. And so, I mean, what's also funny about that is that you'd been, like, holding off telling your parents, and that your mother was such a staunch defender when she actually went in.
Oh, my mom was amazing. Like, when I came out, we didn't speak about it for, like, 5 or 6 weeks, like, post me telling her, and I just assumed it's because it was just something we wouldn't talk about now because, you know, middle-class British family, we don't talk about things. What had been happening is she'd been, like, phoning PFLAG and, like, all of everything she anything she could possibly learn about being gay so that when I asked her questions, she'd have the answers. So that's what she was doing. She wasn't holding off. She was just learning everything she could. Like, she was incredible at the time.
Was that something, like, I can also see that being a little awkward, that she's like, now ask me any questions about being gay.
She didn't, we didn't ever, like, sit down and have her go, so, do you want to know about topping and bottoming? Like, she wasn't like that. It was just, if I had had a comment, then she'd be able to deal with it. But she didn't have to, because I'm like her, I'd already researched it all online.
You should have given her your little book with all the terms that you've been Googling.
Oh, Christ, can you imagine?
It sounds like at that point you have friends who are supportive. You've got sort of a place that you can go to explore the gay world. You've got a family that's supportive. So that's really a very easy, low drama coming out.
But I think when you're 15, 16, it's still the largest thing in your entire world. And I think back then as well, you have to have a conversation with yourself when you realize that at 15, you're probably never going to get married and you're probably never going to have children. And that was a decision, that was a conversation I had to have with myself when I was little. And I always used to think about my wedding. And I always used to think about kids. And at 15, to throw that away, it feels like you're giving something up in order to be yourself.
When you thought about your wedding, what did you imagine?
Oh my God, do you know what? This is currently the only argument me and my boyfriend are having. We're quite good together. We've been together for 9 years and we're not engaged yet because, you know, one of us has to do it. But when I say one of us, I mean me, because he's asked. But he wants a teeny elope wedding. He wants to do it on a beach in the middle of nowhere, whereas I want pageantry. Like, I want a parade. I want everyone to say it's the best day ever. I want to use up everyone's annual leave. Like, you're going to be here for days. Like, I want a massive, massive wedding. Because, like, Catholic weddings are huge. Like, I've got 32 cousins. And so you have to invite everyone, otherwise you're missing people out. And so I need a big wedding. But he does not want that, and this is a proper sticking point, and neither of us are moving. There's no compromise on this. It's like all or nothing right now.
You know, I had a similar conflict with my partner as well, and for a while the solution was, when it's time to have a wedding, because I wanted something very demonstrative, would hire an actor to play
him. Oh my God, this is the exact conversation we've had. It's like, you can recast me, I don't mind.
Yep. It's all right. And everyone, like, a lot of my family has not met him, so they'll never know the difference. And everyone else can just pretend. And,
that's hilarious. So what we should do, so you and I should get married and have our massive wedding. And then our partners, we can just do that later. Like, we'll just go to the courthouse or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. Nobody will know.
That's so funny. I love that the two performer types. Is your partner a performer as well?
No, well, he's very shy. I have a lot of my friends haven't met him.
Wow.
I mean, we've been together for about 13, 14 years.
Crikey.
And so either my friends haven't met him, or they've met him but they don't realize it because I introduce him under an assumed name, so they don't know who he is.
It's turning a little bit of Fight Club. Like, he is like not even real.
There are many people who doubt his existence.
That's incredible.
After, like, over a decade. Yes. It's very new. We just started doing this podcast, Defining Marriage, where we talk about... I wrote a book, Defining Marriage, about the marriage fight. And so we have a podcast about it now, where I read a chapter from the book, and then we chat about it. And James is on that, and it's very new that he is present in any way.
Interesting. That's really cool. You guys are still dealing with that. It's such a weird situation, because your law, like, structure is so twisted and broken. That whole Kim Davis stuff is just ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, it's quite an adventure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm sure, like, in 2000 or so, when you were, like, having that conversation, I mean, it just seemed, like, assumed. Okay, well, no kids, no family.
Yeah, and I had to leave my church. Like, that was the other thing as well. Like, I wasn't going to stay somewhere that didn't like me. And that was a massive thing. That was because I was really involved in the church. Like, I was an altar boy. I was a catechist. Like, I used to help people. I used to give out communion. Like, I was really involved in my local church. And once I came out, that wasn't an avenue available to me anymore. So it was... You give up quite a bit sometimes. I mean, I wouldn't change it now. Like back then, if there was a button, but I think when I was kind of 13, 14, if there was a button I could have pushed that would have made me like everyone else, I would have pushed it. But now there's absolutely no way I'd go anywhere near that.
Did you, when you were leaving the church, was that something that was really important to you? Was it hard to say, to part ways?
It wasn't as important to me. It was very important to my mum. She was really into the church. She loves the community. She likes singing in a group. So she left the church as well because she's quite hard line. She's like, if the Pope says you're not okay, then I can't worship at that church, which was again an incredible thing. And I think that meant more to me, her leaving the church, than me. Like I could have given it up a little bit, but I did enjoy it. I like the basics of what the church teaches. I like treating people nice and being kind to one another and reveling in the joys of smallness. I like that. And so I did miss it a bit. I missed the kind of structure of it sometimes.
Well, so James, the same way, was brought up Catholic, and so I was brought up atheist. So like,
wow,
he was introducing me to all this stuff that's very new. Like all this.
What's it like not having guilt?
Oh no, you find new ways to be guilty. You find all kinds of.
Yeah. My guilt is atomic. Like I get guilt for other people. I get guilt for things other people do, and I feel guilty on their behalf. Oh, it's awful.
Well, if you're sure, someone has to feel guilty. Yeah, but so James will like explain things to me, like, you know, I never had in my upbringing. Well, this is what the Trinity is. So I'm like, so wait, when they say ghost, because I'm imagining the sheet over the head, sort of, like, is that the Holy Ghost? Like,
that never really gets answered. I was just imagining it was like a feeling. You just have to feel him after you. But I brought science to the church as well. Like when I was praying, because you know there's two ways of holding your hands. You can either put them together kind of with your fingers to the top or kind of cross them over each other. I would always have them my fingers at the top because I assumed that my prayer would come directly out the ends of my fingers. So I used to aim it at where God was in the church deliberately.
Sure. Of course. Well,
science.
Exactly. When I was young, there was this giant... I grew up in Connecticut, and there was this big light-up cross on a hill. And my parents, being these staunch atheists, raising two little atheist children, every time we drive by, their explanation was, there's the big T on the hill. Just the letter T.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love that you grew up atheist. I imagine that was actually harder than growing up religious.
It was very frustrating because there were two weekend days that you had to play with your friends, and one of them, everybody was in this church thing that made no sense to me. I'm like, why can't we just have a day to play here? Why is everybody like at work? Why are my friends working?
That's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and the structure of having a religious community was, you know, something that I feel like I might have missed out on.
It was, that was quite nice. I liked the social aspect of it, and my mum made loads of good friends from the school kids and parents, and she's still friends with quite a lot of them now. And so I do think it does, it brings that, yeah, I suppose. It's quite nice.
When you were figuring out the gay world and going to clubs and stuff like that, did you feel like you're kind of having a slightly delayed adolescence?
Oh, God. Oh, yes. Because, again, that's the thing I think that's sad for gay men is you don't get to practice it. Like, cause if you're a young straight person, you can have a girlfriend in like year three when you're, you know, 11. It's like 7, 8, you know, when you're kind of little and you can have like pretend weddings and you can giggle and stuff like that. Whereas when you're gay, you don't really get to do that until you're old enough to fuck your life up with it. So it's like, oh, I'm old enough to buy you loads of presents, or I'm old enough to move into an apartment with you and spend too much cash. Like, you can ruin everything because you haven't had a go. And also, I think you're trying to prove to your parents that you can live a normal life as well. There's that added pressure of, well, this is my first boyfriend, so obviously we're going to get married because this is how this works. Like, I can't be a slut because that's what you think we all are. So I think it's good that now younger gay people can practice, you know, through Tumblr the same way that straight people can, in the way that I couldn't, which I do feel like I missed out on that.
Did you try to make up for lost time as after you'd come out?
What, with slutting it up or boyfriending?
Yeah.
I got a boyfriend really early. My first boyfriend was called Mark. We met on a gay youth forum online, and we went to Birmingham Pride, and we met there. He was a little bit older than me, but he was beautiful, and I loved him. So we fell for each other, and he was sort of my kind of first boyfriend. Just, like, phoned each other all the time, and giggly when I got a text, you know, that kind of thing. It was very sweet. Yeah,
it's kind of striking that you're still you're dating within a system of rules, because you have well, here's the forum, and then we're going to Pride, and there's this is how the community works.
Yes, I'm quite bad when it comes to needing to follow rules. Yeah, breaking rules is a seriously difficult thing for me to do.
Sure. Well, you know, I can imagine, like, if you had brought up in the church and, like, having that little shy boy who's like, okay, don't worry, everyone's going to be judging you.
Yes, it's that. It's the falling out of the mold is quite difficult. Obviously, I'm sort of all right with it now. It's a bit easier now, but it's still an interesting part of my life. Yeah.
So tell me a little about the performance that you're doing then. Are you still involved in singing and dance and theatre?
So I don't really do singing, dance or theatre anymore. It's 100% stand-up comedy. So I'm a professional stand-up comedian. I gig all the time around the country. I get to do a little bit of TV now and then, which is lovely. I did just this year, I was a regular on a panel show called Safe Word, which we have on ITV2. And yesterday I recorded Drunk Histories, which is why my voice is a little bit hoarse today. They got me super duper drunk. Which was fun. So I did that, and so that's kind of my performance now, is me telling jokes and trying to be funny.
What was the bridge from getting up? Because, you know, when you have a script and you're on stage, you know, there's a lot of rules, and it must have been much easier than...
Yeah.
How did you make that jump from, all right, well, now I'm going to start telling jokes?
I've got no idea. So when I was little, we'd do, like, improv-y stuff at secondary school. And so I'd, my weekend drama classes. And so I used to really enjoy that. And I always used to make mine funny, because otherwise I'd be bored. So I used to try and be funny like that. And then I was going to go to drama school when I was going to university. And I applied for a few. And then I got into a lot of them and had a bit of a crisis of confidence and realised that I didn't think I was good enough to be an actor. And if I was worrying now, then it was never going to happen. Because, you know, you have to be ever so slightly delusional in order to have that kind of career. You just have to. I could not be an actor now. It's a nightmare. And so I went and retrained, and I did interactive design at university. And I lived with my boyfriend at the time. And we, as I said, we could, you know, you're able to fuck your life up. So we had an apartment together and we lived together. And then he dumped me because I wasn't attractive anymore, which, you know, is a great reason. I've worked through it now, it's fine. I did a whole Edinburgh show about it, but we moved on. And because of that, I didn't really have many friends. He was quite controlling at the time, so I couldn't really make many friends. And so I joined an improv group. I was living in Leicester. I joined an improv group, which, you know, is making stuff up, but there are still rules in improv. Like, there's, you know, yes and you build on stuff. There's still the rule bit, but it's a little bit more fun to play with. And so I joined that group, and then Leicester, where I was living, has a comedy festival, which is really good and amazing. And they did a stand-up comedy workshop, and I joined that, and it turns out that I was all right at it. And then I started earning money, and then it became my job, and now it's a thing. So I think it kind of came out of all that, sort of stumbled through to it. I mean, I worked hard, but I did stumble into it.
Were your initial stand-ups a bit rough?
So I think if you ask anyone who does any kind of creative endeavor to read back the first steps into what they do now, it would be the worst thing they'd ever read in their entire lives, and it would just ruin everything. I was horrible. Like, I was fine. It was fine. But if I look now, I just cringe. I imagine it was... I think I've blocked it out of my mind in a very healthy Catholic way.
But you must have been... There must have been some promise there, because you kept going.
Yeah, no, I did very well. I was also... I MC a lot, and I'm really good at talking to crowds. Really good at talking to audiences and chatting and kind of building a rapport in the room, just because I think people are fascinating. Like, I love them. So I love to find out about people who are watching comedy, and love chatting to people. And
do you find yourself applying the sort of professional reading a crowd and talking to people and being engaged? Do you find that applying that in life sometimes?
I use my life skills to use it in comedy. Because I don't know if this is how you were, but when you're new and you're coming out and... I was hiding something within me from about the age of 12, and you know that you're hiding it and you don't want people to find it out, and so you end up reading crowds and people and, you know, just dinner tables, figuring out how much of yourself you can let go, how much of yourself you can tell them, how much they will be able to cope with. And so I think that's why gay men are very good entertainers, because they can read rooms, because they have to, because they don't want to cause a fuss or get hit or start an argument. And so we become very good at reading signs, I think, and also being bitchy. But because I think we're also still going to be bitchy because we. So I have my horrible skill that I hate that I have, but I know that I have it, is I'm very good at picking up on somebody's insecurity. And I'm very good at being able to then weaponize that to ruin their lives. Like, I'm a horrible, horrible person with that particular skill, which is very useful when I get heckled at clubs now, because I can shut someone down very fast. But it's a horrible skill. But I think I have that because when I was little, I was constantly trying to mask mine. Like, I think that's what it was. And I think because you become so heightened at that, about how you are presenting yourself to people, that you start being able to read how people present themselves to you. I think that's what it is. That was a very long, rambly answer. I apologize.
At what point were you comfortable sort of exposing more of yourself on stage and talking about being gay on stage?
So when I started, I didn't talk about being gay on stage at all, because I worried that I would be gay comedian David Morgan rather than David Morgan the comedian. But kind of a few months in, I let slip that I had a boyfriend on stage, and the audience audibly went, "Oh," as if I was, that was what I was hiding from them. As if it was like, "Oh, that's what it is. That's, we're getting now. I completely understand it." But before then, I'd just been lying to them. And so I realized that I was like locking off a whole load of my life that I could talk about on stage. And so I started talking a bit about it, and now I talk about it on stage a lot. I talk about kind of weddings and babies and the weird admin that gay life is sometimes, and it's quite nice. I mean, it's a bit of a pain because obviously then some people are like, "Oh, you always talk about being gay." It's like, "Ugh, you're always talking about being a stoner, boring straight boy, so you know, we're both bad at this." So you know, it's I do talk about it now. It does pop up quite a bit now. It's, being gay is hilarious.
It must be quite a relief to be able to be like, "Oh, I don't have to censor that part anymore."
Yeah, yeah. I am bored of coming out. So I come out at the beginning of every show, just because it makes it quicker. And I do it almost irritated that I have to quite a lot now. I had an opening joke that I used to do that would say, you know, I come out. So my opening joke was, so I'm from Birmingham. And they have, it's a very specific accent. A Birmingham accent is like this, right? And it's really kind of nasally, a bit boring, everything's down. And I don't have the accent. And so I say, "Oh, I don't have the accent because, you know, why would you?" What happened is my mum is a bit of a snob. She heard me when I was little going, "Mum, it's raining." So she picked me up by the scruff of the neck, kicked me into Saturday afternoon drama class, and went, "Nobody important has ever spoken like that." And now she's got a gay son. Well done, mother. So that would be my opening joke, and that's what I would do. I'd do it a bit still now, but generally I'll say something or I'll flirt with someone in the audience and be like, "Oh, sorry, I'm a homosexual. I don't know if I had to mention that. This doesn't happen on its own." Like, just throw it out quickly, because then all of your jokes have context, because obviously finding someone funny relies a lot on the context you have of their life. So I have to tell them quite quickly, "I'm a gay person. Oh, let's go." So that's just... it's annoying I have to do it. I hope that one day I become well-known enough that I really don't have to bother anymore.
Sure, sure. Yeah, Graham Norton doesn't have to make the announcement at the start of every show.
He really doesn't. It'd be quite nice if he did. Imagine, come out, "Hi, I'm Graham Norton, I'm a gay man, let's go."
FYI, just so you know, we're going to get that out of the way. And then the audience audibly goes, "Oh.
Oh, that's what it is. We just thought you couldn't find the right girl."
So what have been some milestones? How long have you been doing the stand-up?
I've been in stand-up for 8 years now.
And what are some of the highlights, the big milestones of the...
So I did my first Edinburgh as a group show in 2009, and that was really, really good. It was with four other excellent comedians. Joe Lycett, who's a brilliant bisexual comedian. Alfie Brown, who's a beautiful, beautiful boy. Ivor Graham, who was a teeny tiny child and is now very talented. And then Ben Partridge, who now writes a lot for people. And that was really fun to do that every day in August as my first kind of big Edinburgh. And then I did my first Edinburgh show 2 years after that, 2011, called Triple Threat. And that was brilliant. It got nominated for an award and I got an agent. It was really lovely. And then I did one 2 years, 3 years ago. Was it 2013? I did one called Pretty, and that did really, really, really well. And then last year, I did one called Social Tool. And so that was really good. And then from that, I did like some telly and bigger gigs. And then obviously this year, the big milestone was getting a regular place, a team captain on a panel show, which was really quite good. Yeah, so I was very happy about that.
Tell me about the panel show.
So it's called Safe Word, and it's we don't have roasts in this country. because we're not very good at being mean to people, because I think of years of guilt for being mean to the entire world. So we're not very good at being cruel. So we formatted a roast show. So it was me and a comedian called Catherine Ryan, who's an incredible Canadian comedian. She's unbelievable. And then hosted by a man called Rick Edwards, who is beautiful and very deadpan and lovely. And then two guest comedians and two celebrities. And so the show is that we take the mick out of one celebrity while looking after our celebrity. And then one of the rounds is we take over their social media. So we tweet live as the celebrity, which is my favourite thing to do because it's so much fun. And we do it for real. Like, it's not pretend. We honestly take over their Twitter. And then the next round after that, we roast them. And then they have like a slam match against the two celebs against each other, which is really good fun.
Wow. That's again, highly structured. There's a lot of rules there.
Yes, yes. All the rules. Panel shows are very rule-based. You don't have them over there at all. We've got shed loads of panel shows over here.
Yeah, it's such a shame. So I have to, like, you know, we've got on, I think that's on Netflix, we have QI, which I'm pretty obsessed with, and Buzzcocks, which is great. But I don't know why US TV doesn't have more. I guess we've got Two Girls, One Gay, which, now that I think of it, is Canadian.
Yes, no, it is Canadian.
Five Girls, One Gay.
Yeah. But then that's not really a panel show either. That's just a chat show. It's a formatted kind of round table. But we don't have late night talk shows, and that's all you guys have. They don't work over here, so we've never had like a late night talk show in the vein of, you know, a Tonight Show or a Fallon, whatever. We don't have those. Yeah, we make what I really like about Britain is the audiences here are really discerning, I think, and they can smell bullshit quite quickly. And if you give them the same show over and over again, they just don't want it. And so that's why we don't have 700 cop shows. We have, you know, a couple of really good cop shows, but then things like Happy Valley and Sherlock, which is amazing, and Humans, which is brilliant, and so many good shows right now. Sorry, some really good stuff, and then obviously panel shows and quite a lot of Fact Ent, which is really, there's one at the moment called Hunted, which is really fun, where it's members of the public are told they're being hunted and they have to run away.
What?
Yeah, so like, and then it's all through. It's like they're being tracked by professional people who are like looking through all their social media and stuff and trying to figure out, and they kind of rob stuff from their house to figure out where they go. It's really fascinating. It's a really good show. It's all about surveillance and stuff, because we're obviously a very surveilled country.
I kind of love the premise of this, because it's very tempting to fantasize that you are a fascinating person and someone is following your every move.
Yeah, that is interesting, actually, because I think a couple of them are a bit like that, a bit kind of like, it's kind of horrifying. But then on telly, they'll tell you what they've been Google searching and what that means about them, and so where they might go to. It's brilliant. Like, I would like to think I'd be good at it, because I'm so aware of how everything works, but I'm equally aware that I could not survive very long in a tent in the middle of Yorkshire. Like, that would be awful.
If you could develop the perfect dream show for yourself, what kind of show do you want to be doing? Or are you doing the show that you want to be doing now?
Oh, God. I got asked this recently. I had a meeting, which was very lovely. And I was like, hey, I want to do this. So, I love E! I like hearing about things that don't matter from the mouths of really attractive people. And you have there's like The Soup, which I think is properly funny. And then Chelsea Lately As Was and Fashion Police. So I kind of want to make a show like that, which is kind of what I want to do. Well, essentially what I want to make is SportsCenter for people that care about the Real Housewives of Atlanta. That's the show I want, because I would watch that. I'm still a boy. Like, I still care about stats and I care about like their lives. I just want that television show. So that's my dream show would be to make a match of the day, but about reality television and entertainment, because I think it's a bit more important than sport, but doesn't get as much coverage ever.
Well, I would absolutely watch that, because I need a digest, because there's just so much. I need someone to like sum it up for me.
Yeah, because you're like, oh, this is why she's mad. Because I remember I got into The Real Housewives of Melbourne, which is brilliant, and I missed a few episodes. And all they spoke about the whole season was about how one of them said something to Gina. And through all the Googling in the world, I could not find out what someone had said about Gina. Like, I was just like, what did she call her? And obviously they don't say the word, because it's television. You can't say the C word on anything but British telly. And it was, it was amazing. So I want that. I want someone to digest for me all the stuff that I should know before I watch it.
Well, I would watch every episode of that. If people want to find the work that you're doing now, where can they find you?
Probably my website, thisisdavid.com, or I'm thisisdavid on pretty much every social network that exists, because I'm a nerd and like being involved.
Fabulous. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. It's been really fun. It's nice talking about yourself, isn't it?
Thanks again to David for joining me. You can find him on Twitter at ThisIsDavid and at ThisIsDavid.com. He has live shows coming up all over the UK. And by the way, thanks to everyone who joined us last week for another live video chat. I was joined on camera by Cody Melcher, host of the podcast Tomefoolery, and the delightful Brady Ginn. We chatted with viewers live about love stories, Saved by the Bell, the sex lives of Star Wars cantina aliens, and the importance of sexy underwear. You can watch the chat on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/MattBaum, and stay tuned for the next one. For my recommendation this week, I asked my Twitter and Facebook followers to suggest movies where parents defend their kids for being different, and I got a lot of great ones. Empire, Door to Door, Cher and Mask, Ugly Betty, Glee, Get Real, big thanks to Jolene who suggested Big Eden, and to Joel who brought up Family Stone. Chanpuri mentioned Tilda Swinton in The Deep End, Eric suggested Prayers for Bobby and the mom in Jeffrey. A lot of folks still remember Debbie on Queer as Folk. Every single one of these is touching and beautiful and heartbreaking, but not one comes close to the mom in Dumbo. Maybe it's been a little while since you've seen the film. If so, you need to give it another look, because it is so much more adult than you noticed when you were a kid. First, there's the scene where Dumbo's mom defends him from onlookers who want to pull his ears. She attacks to save her son, and it is full-on dark Disney. And then there's the scene when they've been separated, and she sings Baby Mine. All the animals in the circus are able to sleep close to family, but she's been locked away and can just barely touch Dumbo with her trunk. Take a deep breath when you watch this scene, particularly if you're a parent, because it will destroy you. Somehow, in the middle of what is ostensibly a kid's cartoon, there is a devastating portrait of a mother willing to lay down her life to defend her oddball child. And that's how it should be, right? A parent's job is to protect their kid, even when that kid is a little strange. In fact, especially when that kid is strange. Over our lives, we've gotten used to the idea that when a parent rejects their kid for being gay, that's just business as usual, because it's always been like that, right? But no, parental rejection shouldn't be normal. Then now that's changing. There's lots more moms out there like David's who stand up for their queer kids. And more moms like Dumbo's who remind us how brave it can be to care for those you love. Big thanks to Richard Smith, a.k.a. Fagburn, for suggesting Dumbo. And thanks again for listening. It's listeners who make this show possible. If you're enjoying it, head over to Patreon and do a search for Sewers of Paris to pledge your support. Huge thanks to all the people stepping up to support the podcast. I'm so grateful to everyone who's helping to sustain the show and keep it growing. If you have any thoughts on today's show, please get in touch. Tweet at me, at Matt Baum. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com, and please keep rating and reviewing the show in the iTunes store. Those reviews make a huge difference. Check out my book, Defining Marriage, now out in paperback and audiobook. You can find it at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time, croissant.